You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, March 11th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everybody.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
What's going on?
Evil.
Evil
is afoot.
Evil.
What happened now?
I thought it was more of a hand.
Someone switched this thing to evil.
Beware. Beware the Ides of March. That's today.
March 15th already?
It is. And you know what happens every March 15th? Bad stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, ever since 44 BC, I guess.
Zombification, maybe?
Yeah, the zombie of Julius Caesar rises from the dead once a year to roam the earth.
And so, he distributes candy to all the kids.
Right. Disgusting candy, though. It's like chocolate-covered dormice, mostly.
You know, the Ides of March is one of those things that I heard about, like, for the vast majority of my life and never really knew what it meant until about, you know, maybe 5 years ago.
That's true
really?
Of most people today, yep. Jay.
Yeah,
didn't
I know.
Did you have to read Julius Caesar in high school?
I probably did and forgot it, and, you know, who knows.
I loved it. I don't know why, but I loved it so much that the year that we had to read Julius Caesar, I played Mark Antony in a stage production.
Oh, wow.
The Ides of March are best known. So first of all, Ides just refers to basically the middle of the month. It's how the Romans referred to the middle of the months. March is currently our first month or our third month, but to the Romans, it was the first month of their year. And so the Ides of March were generally, like New Year's sort of holidays where they would sacrifice animals and, I don't know, get drunk, whatever you do. Until 44 BC, when a group of senators assassinated Julius Caesar. They gathered around him and stabbed him to death, basically.
But what about Brutus?
Brutus was one of them.
Et tu, Brute?
He didn't necessarily say that, but it was popularly known that he had said that by the time Shakespeare wrote his play. So Shakespeare included that line, but they don't really know what his last words were. Some people said he didn't say much of anything except for like, yeah.
Why did you stab me? Why?
Pizza.
Although someone said much later that he said something along the lines of, and you too, my son. And that was eventually changed into.
I can see your house from here.
Rebecca, to be extremely accurate, the Ides of March means the 13th or the 15th of the month. It's not really just the middle of the month.
Well, yeah. I mean, I said the middle of the month because it's not always the 15th. It's actually, for most of the time, it's on the 13th. It's the 15th for a couple of months. It's supposed to be based on the full moon.
Yeah,
this would have been the first full moon of the new year to the Romans.
No surprise.
Yeah, but the one funny, not funny, I guess there's still a death involved.
Depends who dies.
Too soon.
One interesting fact of the assassination of Julius Caesar is that his autopsy was one of the first, well, the earliest known posthumous medical report known.
Cool.
Yeah.
How many knife wounds?
That he died by a bunch of holes. Lots of holes in his body.
That's called a forensic autopsy.
Yeah.
If you're trying to figure out how somebody was murdered or, you know, how they were killed, as opposed to a regular autopsy.
And the other skeptic-y sort of thing, again, if you've read Shakespeare, you know that the date was preceded by ominous portents, like crows being gutted and worms are inside and there's an eclipse and floods and
boils.
Things like that. And like all of these omens were said to have occurred like just before, throughout the execution, and for days afterward. It was just like one nonstop parade of portents. So probably not. probably just made up later, but.
Of course.
There you have it.
Guys, do you know what else March 15th signifies in a weird sort of way?
What?
It, according to, Cosmos, it signifies if you took the entire history of the universe and compressed it into one calendar year, a cosmic year, March 15th is the birthday of the Milky Way galaxy.
That's right.
Aww. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
I didn't get it anything. Damn it.
What do you get the guy that has everything, Ev?
The Andromeda Galaxy.
More hydrogen.
More helium.
Hey, Bob, speaking of Cosmos, what did you think?
What did they get wrong, Bob?
Well, we got to start.
Let's get right to the dirt.
We got to start by saying I absolutely loved it. I mean, I've seen tons of these science documentaries where there's amazing graphics and everything, but this one was just extra, extra special for, you know, not only was it technically extremely well done, but I think it was a fantastic successor to the original Cosmos. Tyson did a fantastic job. Although he's, you know, I kind of missed Carl at sometimes, yeah. You know, just his delivery and his presence is such huge shoes to follow. But Neil did a fantastic job. I thoroughly loved it. I mean, I was teary-eyed at the end, especially when he was talking, when they showed those great videos of Carl Sagan and he showed his book. I was like, oh my God. but of course, did you guys feel similarly? I assume you better.
Well, to complete the segue here, we're talking about Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. This is, hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson. Executive producer is Seth MacFarlane. Of Family Guy fame.
Written by Anne Druyan, Carl's wife.
She's also an executive producer. Yeah, Anne Druyan. Yep. So this is a follow-up, kind of a remake of the original Cosmos series by Carl Sagan. And the first episode aired recently. We all watched it. So I agree, Bob. Overall, it was obviously fantastic. I love the idea of the science documentary Cosmos, you know, the broad sweeps of trying to make, you know, how science allows us to make sense of our place in the universe, which is essentially what the theme of the first episode was.
And, you know, the fact that this aired on Fox in the US is, I think, a really great aspect of it. For those outside of the US, this is the type of programming that would normally be aired on PBS, our one, you know, public television network that is not very highly viewed, except for like Downton Abbey and, you know, some things like that. But Fox is like one of the big four networks. So to me, it's a huge leap forward that this level of science programming is on Fox with no talking dogs or anything like
right
that.
And not just that, Rebecca, not just that, this was simultaneously broadcast to a half a billion viewers over, like, I think 220 outlets in 181 countries. And then you had President Obama's introduction, which was
loved
really good
that.
I mean, you add all that together and this is like almost a milestone. It's really, the send-off was just so beautiful. I love it. It was also on not just Fox, but was it National Geographic?
Yeah,
or
National Geographic.
Was
yes.
It
yeah.
National Geographic?
Yes.
And oh my God, I mean, there's so many people. I was just so happy. I was better than even I expected. My expectations were pretty high, I think.
You know, about the Fox point that Rebecca made, we have to thank Seth MacFarlane, I think probably solely for that. Because essentially what he did, if you're familiar with, you know, all the shows he produces and stuff, he is giving up part of his Sunday night primetime lineup or his slot on that Sunday night in order to allow this to happen. And, you know, with no small part, did Seth have, I'm sure, in not only bringing it to Fox, but also giving the space in order for Cosmos to live in a primetime slot. So kudos to him.
Definitely. There's so many good things about this type of programming. Of course, this is the pinnacle. This is the type of thing that we've been talking about over and over, where we need science in the media. We need a personality. Neil deGrasse Tyson is the absolute pinnacle of science and critical thinking, in my opinion. He's the face of it. And this program, you know, just makes it all come full circle and makes it complete now. You know, his mission to the dark side is finally, is finally there. I'm psyched that it's him. I think that he's going to be excellent on this show. And I think that, guys, think about this, how profound the original Cosmos was to so many people like us growing up It had an impact on the world, and I think this program is potentially has that same level of impact.
He was the logical choice for this position for lots of different reasons. Obviously, we know Neil deGrasse Tyson to be a tremendous communicator of science in the modern day, but also he has a relationship with Carl Sagan, and he talks mm-hmm. about that at the end of the episode, which I thought was great. And when we've interviewed him before, he's talked about the same story in which he, in 1975, he was invited up to Cornell University, and he was a teenager at the time, and Carl Sagan, you know, basically took him by the hand and walked him all around the campus and stuff. And, you know, he got basically, he was in the presence of this great scientist and someone he really looked up to. It was a correct continuation of the Cosmos series with Neil deGrasse Tyson on every level.
All right. Can we talk about nitpicking and criticisms now?
Yeah, let's
please.
Get to
sure.
it.
Let's do sure. it.
Of course.
I thought it was, again,
I think it's just the first episode as well. And, you know, I think there's 13 episodes that they've produced. So here are all my nitpicks. I have to say, as a preface, I love the original Cosmos, not just because of Carl, not just because of the content, but it really was a game changer for science documentaries. And I really, since then, I haven't seen another documentary that hits the sweet spot in terms of content, vibe, the music, the way it was delivered, how personal it was. It really was, you know, a personal journey. That was kind of the theme of the original Cosmos, and Sagan did it beautifully. So my expectations were extremely high. I think that where the first episode, again, I hope it gets better, but where I think it fell short of my probably too high expectations were in a few ways. One, the music on the new series was terrible, in my opinion.
Really?
Okay, I'm really glad you said that. Somebody else on Skeptic said a similar thing, and they clearly know way more than me about music because they knew who the composer was and everything. But yeah, I found that it was really uninspired. Like, it was standard orchestral. It
exactly.
was like you could go online and just, yeah, Google inspiring orchestra piece and fit that in.
Yeah, it was just like this, you know, just, yeah, in the background kind of orchestra, kind of vaguely following the mood of the dialogue and what was going on. But there was, it was really flat. And also as opposed to, I love the music in the original Cosmos.
Oh, yes.
Love
yes.
it. I would hear that Vangelis theme and I would instantly be in the series. You know what I mean? It would put me in the mood for it. It gives me chills listening to that today.
Like the oboe, the parts where the oboe comes in and those little subtle, you know.
Everything. It was
crescendos
brilliant.
And things. It absolutely, 100%.
This music and, is not going to do that. It's
it
just
was
not,
flat.
Yeah. All right. Special effects. Obviously, the quality of the special effects is off the hook, and it was gorgeous, and I love him taking the ship of the imagination through the multiverse. You know, that's great. Mm-hmm. But I felt they were a little science fiction-y, meaning that they're the meteors flying past the screen, and you hear it whizzing past. Come on.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
That's a bit Star Trek-y.
You can't say you like the ship of the imagination and then say it's too sci-fi. Like,
no, I meant in that very, in other words, they did the things that science fiction special effects movies do that you sort of give them a pass on because it's Star Wars.
Oh, that screw up the science.
Yeah. So one was the sound of objects moving past because it's mm-hmm. space. You know, give me the music. Mm-hmm. And the other one was, Bob, come on, in the asteroid belt.
Oh, come on, the asteroid belt. That immediately leaped out at me. They were just too close. You literally saw hundreds of asteroids together. And when in fact, if you were standing on one asteroid, you wouldn't be able to see another asteroid because it's just so far away. Now, of course, we understand.
Well, they have to take a liberty. They
it would be boring as hell to be in an asteroid field and see one asteroid. Okay. I kind of get it. But I mean,
no,
if you're going
to
go for that extra mile,
go really fast, fly really
fast.
Or say like, here's what we normally think of when we think of being in an asteroid belt.
Okay.
And show that. And then say, but here's what it would really be like. And then show like this desolate asteroid. And like that would be really cool. And I would
remember
it.
Well, how about this? I agree. And here's a third option. Do what they did for the Oort cloud. Get a very extended view very far away and show the asteroid belt in its entirety with all of the asteroids. Then you can get a sense of how many there are there. So yeah, so that was a little bit annoying and I noticed it and everybody does that. Everybody does
that's
that
the thing, but Cosmos doesn't get a pass.
Yeah.
They do the typical.
That's why I had a problem with
it. Yeah, so there was like, a few cliche aspects to the special effects that I think Cosmos should be better than that.
Right.
And,
so,
you know, I have an issue with the Spaceship of the Imagination.
Oh, no. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly the response I expect from you guys, but that's not the response that you would get from, like, you know that this is going to be played in front of thousands of 10th grade biology students. To you, the ship of the imagination is this cool callback, but to them, like, it's going to be really cheesy, you know? And I think that the way that the ship of the imagination looks really dated now to us for the original, I think that this one is going to look dated in another 10 years at least.
You think so?
A lot of kids right now, I think they're going to look at it and be like, it looks like, I mean, come on. It's really kind of hokey. But, you know.
What would you have rather seen, Rebecca?
I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was cool. But, you know, you don't necessarily need. I think that it was a callback. I think it was
a callback
to get people excited about it. And so in that respect, I think it's good. But I just think that to a lot of like the younger crowd, they might see it as pretty hokey.
I can see that. That's a good point.
I disagree. I really don't think they would. I really liked it. And thanks to Seth MacFarlane though for making sure that ship was in there because it wasn't necessarily going to be in there. And that would be an egregious error, I think.
Although it wasn't a dandelion though. They departed from the dandelion.
Yeah, they did. They couldn't do that again. But the thing is, I liked how unconventional it was in that there was no obvious, you know, one end is propulsion and the other end is where the bridge is type of thing. I liked that. Yeah. I loved how the reflections, if you look at the reflections on that, that must have been so difficult to do because this thing is mirror smooth. So it had to reflect everything in its environment. And I thought those scenes were beautifully done. I don't know. I liked it. I liked how it could reorient itself.
Compare it to J.J. Abrams' Starship Enterprise. No way would this program have, you know, the budget or the interest in doing something like an Enterprise. But I'm saying that when J.J. Abrams' Enterprise is the kind of standard that people have come to expect of spaceships, I think that, like, what we got was, like, delightfully hokey.
Yeah, but I think that fits because this is a spaceship of the imagination. It's just an individual little cocoon
right, that's
for
great
some
if
you're person.
Talking to, like, adults who love the original and 7-year-olds. Right.
Well, this is unresolvable.
Not necessarily for, like,
it's a good point, Rebecca. I agree with you, too. I mean, all she's saying is the ship's got to be cool, and it's got to be cool to a lot of different age ranges. That's all.
Yeah. No, just to me. All right. next feature of the series. Actually, this is a positive. I like this. So in the original Cosmos, when they did historical flashbacks, they did live action.
Acted. Yes.
And it was hokey, but you kind of gave it a pass because it was Cosmos. But in this one, in the new Cosmos, they did a really stylized cartoon, which I loved. I liked
Makes
it.
Makes sense.
I thought it was better.
Seth MacFarlane
is
Giordano Bruno. Going to be drawing animation. Yes, and they touched on Bruno, which, you know, it didn't get hardly any attention in the first Cosmos series.
He was the primary focus.
So right, yes.
So what was your favorite quote? Favorite quote of Bruno? He said one line that I really loved when he's at the podium trying to convince everybody that the universe is, you know, much bigger than they could imagine.
Well, there's always the classic, your God is too small.
Yes, I just love that quote. It's just like,
I mean, this is what I wrote about over on Skeptic, though. Something that I found very interesting was the choice of Bruno. You know, leading up to this, I wanted to see how they would treat religion because Neil deGrasse Tyson is probably an atheist, but generally does not identify himself as atheist and doesn't attack religion, and kind of like what we do on this show, doesn't really talk about religion until it directly intersects with his field of interest. Seth MacFarlane, though, is openly atheist and likes giving religion a hard time. So I found it interesting.
I never noticed.
If you look at the original Cosmos, they do not start with Giordano Bruno. They talk about Eratosthenes. Sorry.
Or is it Aristosthenes?
Eratosthenes. The guy who figured out that the earth was round and even figured out the diameter of the earth to an incredibly accurate degree.
All with a stick and a piece of rope essentially.
And this recent incarnation began about 1800 years later with Giordano Bruno, who was not a scientist. He was a philosopher. And Tyson mentions this in Cosmos. He says, that Bruno's point about how the universe was possibly endless, and that everything circled the, or that our Earth circles the sun, it was a guess, and it could have easily been wrong. He didn't have any science to back it up. There are a million other places to start when you're talking about how we know what we know about the cosmos. Why start with Giordano Bruno? And I think it's a really deliberate choice, and I think it shows an interest in, even though they're creating this pop cultural science education piece that is meant to appeal to a broad spectrum of people, I think that they're deliberately showing that they are not afraid to jump into the science versus religion fray and talk about the things that, you know, really are coming to a head even now with, you know, evolution versus creationism. You know, and so, I mean, I was interested because I'm not sure if this is going to turn off religious people and therefore be a bad place to start, or if it's the best place to start because this is a conversation that we need having, this idea of dogma sort of pushing down scientific progress. So, I don't know, what did you guys think of that?
No, I loved it. It's also true to Sagan, who didn't pull any punches. Sagan was never mean or insulting. He just was very matter of fact.
And disagree with you, though.
No,
I don't think he was ever mean. But if you look at the first episode, Sagan talks about, for instance, the Library of Alexandria, and he talks about Hypatia, but never once does he mention religion. He doesn't mention religious bigots who possibly killed Hypatia or contributed to the burning of the library. So I think he did pull punches in that case. I think he was probably concerned with turning off religious people.
Well, Rebecca, that's actually just not true. In that segment, Carl Sagan talks about the fact that the scientists at the library did not oppose the religious assumptions of the society in which they were living. He talks about abject surrender to mysticism, and he talks about the early Christian church consolidating their power, and the followers of Cyril, who was later made a saint, were the fanatics who attacked and killed Hypatia and burned the library. He absolutely confronted the religious question, but he just did it in a way, in a matter-of-fact way, that made it seem as if it wasn't a full frontal assault. He was just telling you the history. But getting back to the current cosmos, the Neil deGrasse Tyson version, so it is a good sign that they spend so much time talking about Giordano Bruno. And, you know, who knows? Maybe he thought that Bruno was an obscure enough character that he can get away with that without upsetting, you know, too many religious people.
I mean, maybe. I was thinking that. It occurred to me that, you know, if I were watching this when I was younger, when I was still a Christian, it might not even occur to me, like, oh, those guys aren't like my pastor.
Yeah.
But, you know, with looking at it through the eyes of a secularist, you know, it's pretty clear the...
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
The Pope character, like, they are very evil looking, you know, they all have these dark rimmed eyes.
We know who the villains are. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even when he's on the pyre, someone thrusts a cross in his face and he turns his face away. Like, that's a very direct message.
Yeah,
really,
that definitely is.
I think it just reflects the times. Go ahead, Ev.
I have a nitpick. There was something missing from this first episode of The New Cosmos. Now, I'll read you a quote from the very beginning, from the, you know, some of the first minutes of the original first episode of Cosmos. "We wish to find the truth, no matter where it lies. But to find the truth, we need imagination and skepticism both. We will not be afraid to speculate, but we will be careful to distinguish speculation from fact." So I found that the word skeptic and skepticism was missing in this first episode. Whereas Carl, one of the things I admired so much about Carl Sagan is not only obviously all the science stuff, but he pulled no punches about his skepticism, and was never either afraid to use the word, term himself a skeptic, or, you know, use it as part of the concepts he was trying to explain to people. I'm not yet getting that sense from this new cosmos that we're going to be seeing that. And especially when we're going to get to the later episodes, because in the original series, I think it was episode 11, in which they talk about the Betty and Barney Hill case, you know, the UFO abduction case, and how, you know, basically the evidence for that was all flimsy and fell apart. And that's that episode is really about skepticism. I don't know if we're going to see something like that in this upcoming Cosmos series. I hope it's not a forebearer, a harbinger of lack of the term skepticism and looking at pseudoscience and putting it in its proper context to science. I hope we don't miss an opportunity here with this new Cosmos series.
Well, Ev, I'm not surprised that they probably, you know, I'm guessing, but it seems like they deliberately didn't use the word skepticism. And you know, it's a difficult topic to talk about because of how much time it would take to really cover it. But sure, I think it makes sense because, you know, skepticism has been abused. The word has been abused. It's been misused. It's not crystal clear what skepticism is to people that aren't in the know, that don't read the literature and don't listen to the podcasts and read the blogs and everything. I mean, we're in the minority. People call themselves skeptics today and they're pseudoscientists.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not a good term anymore, in my opinion, that clearly states who and what we are and what the movement is.
Yeah, but I'm not giving it up. I'm going to fight for my skeptic label. Mm-hmm. All right, a couple more really, really quick nitpicks. One is the pace was, I think, a little frenetic. Not as bad as your average modern documentary. I kind of don't like the style that the sort of reality TV style that documentaries tend to get into, where they have this sort of frenetic pacing, like short attention span theater kind of thing. I love the original Cosmos because I thought the pace was perfect. It was really relaxed without being slow. And I'm not sure they hit the sweet spot with this. It was good. It was better than most documentaries, but maybe I still felt like they were throwing special effects at me a little fast. Like I couldn't look at something for more than 3 seconds at a time without getting bored. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the cuts were definitely more compared to present day television. They were more in line with that.
Yeah, but don't forget, I mean, that's been a long time since the original Cosmos. You know, you know how movies, when you look at certain older movies, I saw E.T. with my daughter when she was young, and I watching it with her, I was like, oh my God, this is boring. I was in shock at a movie that I absolutely loved, one of the best movies ever, and my perception of it completely changed because you just become so inured to this fast pace and everything flying at you. So that might be part of it. But I wanted to throw out one thing that I found a bit jarring, if not necessarily a scientific nitpick. Remember when they showed the Earth 250 million years ago? And then they showed the Earth 250 million years in the future. And it was just, it just struck me as odd. All right. They showed a planet that was clearly incredibly scientifically advanced. There was obvious evidence of a very sophisticated culture on the planet, lights everywhere, some unusual structures, and in orbit around the planet, they looked like they were these platforms, these amazing structures built in orbit. I mean, and I really couldn't even tell exactly what they were. But the thing that struck me though was that, wait a second, this is 250 million years in the future. It's almost pointless to think, oh, look how advanced we're going to be in 250 million years. Sorry.
We'll have space platforms.
We're going to be that advanced in 500 years at least, you know, let alone 250 million, unless we get wiped out and more.
Bob, those weren't humans. Those were like three species from now.
Right. Humans are all dead.
Some of them were part
humans. I agree with Bob. That's what it would have to be. Yes.
those were our robot descendants.
And I thought of that. And I thought of that too.
It's an arbitrary number in the future. You know, like, you know, of course, Bob, but what are you going to do? Like, they just wanted to show like a super advanced.
It was cool. I loved it. I wanted to take a picture of it. It was an amazing image of the Earth.
We're like space elevators though, right? There should have been shafts.
Well, you know, you can still watch it on Hulu Plus and take a screenshot. I mean,
by that point, Bob, we'll be the Krell and we'll just think about what we want and it'll become real.
Krell is in things that get eaten by whales?
No, not Krill. Krell is in Forbidden Planet. Come on.
Oh.
And want to make it clear, overall, love the first episode. I think this could be a huge win for science communication. Hope it's going to inspire a new generation of science nerds and science aficionados, you know, do for the new generation what it did for all of us, right, when we were younger. And I do think that Neil deGrasse Tyson is the perfect person, perfect successor for the series. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it can't be anybody else doing this.
We'll come back to this, you know, maybe at the end when we've seen all 13 episodes. Maybe it might be a good idea to come back and talk about it again.
That's a good idea.
Okay. Can I just give a quick shout out to CFI because I don't have live television, But CFI has been hosting, well, last Sunday they hosted a live thing in a bar where you could go and watch the series for free. And they're going to be doing it again this Sunday. So if you don't have live TV, go online. You might be able to find another group that's sponsoring it. Or maybe you could convince a bar to turn the channel to Fox during Cosmos and have your own gathering.
Well, we have a great interview with Jennifer Ouellette coming up later in the show. But I think we might have time for a few news items to squeeze in between now and then. So, Evan, tell us about the flight that was lost over the Pacific. What was that, Oceanic Flight 815?
No, I think that was something else from someone else. Someone else. What happened is that back on March 8th, a Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 passenger aircraft disappeared off of air traffic radar screens on a midnight flight out of Kuala Lumpur. And the plane was carrying 227 passengers, 12 crew as well. And it just literally seemed to vanish in thin air, practically. The last radio contact was 40 minutes into the flight. The flight was bound for Beijing, China. Well, first and foremost, I mean, this is a tragedy in that 239 people are missing and likely dead. You know, and there are thousands of relatives, loved ones, associates of these people who are grief-stricken. They're left with only questions and absolutely no answers. I mean, really, because can you guys remember a time in your life in which something like this has happened, in which a plane has just fallen off the map, essentially? They can't find where's the wreckage? Why did all the signals from the plane suddenly cease? And why can't we pinpoint the position of the plane based on the last information we had with it? The search area has widened out just in the recent last day or so to a much, much larger stretch, because I think they're kind of grasping at straws at this moment.
Evan, isn't it safe to assume because of the two passports that were stolen and those people, the fake people, went on that airplane, probably terrorism?
Yeah, right. I mean, wouldn't you you would think that? And, you know, we might have a predisposition sort of to think it, especially those of us here, you know, in the United States who were, you know, very close to what happened on 9/11.
But usually, you know, with terrorism, the terrorists want you to know. Like, that's the entire point of terrorism, is to tell people, like, we did this. But
now, what I wonder, though, is if you take any flight with 200-plus passengers and you do a careful review of all the passengers, how often will you find some irregularities like stolen passports?
Well, yeah, like, Interpol said something along – like, something really alarming, like, well, nobody really looks for stolen passports. But Steve, you're absolutely right. Yeah, there could be two for every 300 people on a plane.
Yeah, that may be average. Right. So we don't know. It seems suspicious, but we don't know how predictive it is without more information.
Also, from Interpol and the police, they say that the proprietors of a travel agency in the resort town of Pattaya sold one-way tickets to the two men.
Really?
On the flight. And apparently they used cash to pay for them.
All right. Now that's more suspicious.
Right. It is more suspicious. However, despite our inclinations to start to draw conclusions when we really don't have any evidence at hand, we have to remind ourselves that we don't have any evidence at hand. And it is dangerous to sort of draw these kinds of conclusions when we have nothing. But, you know, human nature abhors a void, right? So we look to fill it with as much as we can. And as the more time goes by, conspiracy theories are going to start to fill this void. And actually, they already have. Everything from missiles took it down. You know, someone snuck a bomb onto the plane. And it is already starting, yes. Although I'm not sure how serious they are, but alien involvement, you know, ETs from other planets, they will close encounters action here, in which whole, you know, ships and planes and stuff go missing in the middle of the night.
You know, planes sometimes disappear over the ocean. Although, from what I understand, the ocean is not very deep over its flight path. It's not like it was it was flying over the Marianas Trench or something. It was, I think, 50 meters deep.
Oh boy, that's nothing.
Yeah, it's really nothing. But still, it's a big place. You know,
it's a large expanse to go through.
So, and what if, like, Flight 800, remember, just exploded in midair because of a fuel tank malfunction? What if something like that happened and there's really just pieces?
Wouldn't some be floating on the ocean surface?
Yeah, you would think if there were an explosion, but how long would that happen? How long would the stuff float for? I don't know.
Well, part of the problem here, guys, is that depending on the altitude of the airplane, they didn't know exactly where it was over the ocean. The ocean is vast. And by the time they could get out to even close to where they think the plane was last, everything could have sunk already.
That's what I was asking.
The plane was at 35,000 feet at 40 minutes into the flight, and the last tracking they had is that it suddenly made an unscheduled turn towards the west, dropped in its elevation, and that was the last reading
and
they had on it.
Disappeared off of radar.
Yep, disappeared off radar. And no emergency signals went out, right? I mean, what do you guys think about the possibility of pilot suicide? Federal administration data shows that 24 pilots have killed themselves crashing planes in the last two decades. And two of the more recent ones, 1997 and 1999. Again, these were big passenger planes. In which,
how does that even happen in this day and age when you've got a co-pilot, though?
At least in the case of 1999, in which it was an Egypt Air flight, the pilot struggled with the co-pilot. The co-pilot wanted to take the plane down, and the pilot was fighting him on the way down. But unfortunately, they didn't. He wasn't able to do anything about it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Once you get the planes past a certain angle, there's no recovery.
There's no recovery. So more to come. This is a genuine mystery, and let's remain skeptical about things we hear and see out there and hope that they can solve this fast so that conspiracy theories can, have less room to maneuver.
All right, Bob, tell us about the Earth raising shields.
Yeah, this is interesting. It appears the Earth...
did Riker give the command?
Yeah, oh, boy. Let's steal my thunder. It appears that the Earth has an additional set of shields that it can raise to protect itself, and we don't even need Picard to say...
Raise shields.
Engage.
Make it so. This protection takes the form of a shield of plasma, so-called plasmasphere, which is a word I love, that can augment the protection of our magnetosphere from the nasty charged particles of the solar wind. Now, this has been theorized for a while, but Brian Walsh at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and his colleagues, they've dotted all their I's and crossed all their T's, and they proved it, as only science can do. The magnetosphere, as you may know, is a bubble of magnetism surrounding and protecting the Earth, caused by the motion of molten iron alloys in the outer core of the Earth. Now, this protects us from solar wind, and without it, life on Earth would really suck. It would probably consist of only sea creatures deep enough underwater that they'd be unaffected, or either that, or we'd have to have evolved some sort of really hardy natural protection. But clearly things would be very, very different. So this geodynamo is not perfect protection, though. There's a phenomenon called magnetic reconnection that basically links the magnetic field lines of the sun with our own magnetosphere. But this allows little cracks in the shield. It allows some charged particles in, causing beautiful auroras, of course, but also it can cause geomagnetic storms that do all sorts of nasty things to our navigation systems and our power grids. We've all heard about that. So magnetic reconnection causes actually the most powerful explosions in the universe. And I'm not talking about Jay after he eats meatballs or Thai food. I'm talking about solar flares. The sun.
Yeah, he's right.
Yeah. I laughed. Good one.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Okay. Thank you. I was waiting for that. It's been about 20 news items since I've heard you chuckle.
You got one.
Okay. It's not bad. It's better. Doing better. So the sun stores a boatload of energy over days in its various magnetic fields. And this can all be released within minutes by these magnetic field lines reconnecting on the surface of the sun. So it has the potential to build up lots of power. So for extra protection, then the Earth does something pretty cool. There's gas in our upper atmosphere, and it has its electrons stripped away by ultraviolet radiation to create the fourth and most common state of matter in the entire universe, a plasma. Now, this plasma forms a ring around the Earth, and that's what's called the plasmasphere. The idea, then, is that an unusually strong electric field from the sun can suck away this plasma during reconnection and causing this plume that rises until it reaches this boundary layer that exists between our magnetic field and the sun's. So this buffer of extra material, then, makes it harder for magnetic reconnection from reaching its full potential, and that's where the protection is right there. So the experiment they did to do this was pretty cool. They used GPS sensors on the ground, and the science using that, they saw these filaments, these little fingers of plasma moving away from the North Pole, and this is the plume that I was talking about. And at the same time, NASA's spacecraft, Themis, I think it's pronounced, passed through the boundary between the Earth's and sun's magnetic field and measured a 2-order of magnitude increase in the number of electrons. That's the plume. So Brian Wall said, for the first time, we are able to monitor the entire cycle of this plasma stretching from the atmosphere to the boundary between Earth's magnetic field and the sun's. It gets to that boundary and helps protect us. keeps these solar storms from slamming into us. So now the plume doesn't appear all the time. So future experiments should help us elucidate, you know, when it occurs and more precisely how. So the next time the Earth gets slammed by a coronal mass ejection, be very thankful that no one had to say, "Shields up!"
Make it so.
Engage.
Engage.
Scottsdale, Arizona.
How about this? Not now, Wesley.
Oh, boy.
All right. Couple more quick news items. We've had a lot of emails over the last couple of weeks about the meat study. Do you guys hear about this? A study that shows that eating meat and cheese is as bad for you as smoking?
Yes.
I'm going to live forever. Except for all the cheese I eat.
Burger's good. Yeah.
I instantly got paranoid when I read that.
I was amazed. And the study to me seemed good. They tracked lots of people for like 2 decades. And I was shocked. And I was actually considering minimizing my meat intake. I mean, until Steve said, "It's probably baloney," but I can't wait to hear what you have to say, Steve. Hit me.
Well, baloney is meat.
Yeah, the study it's an observational study, so we can only find correlations, cannot make conclusions about causation. Let's be clear about that up front. And they did track protein intake and a lot of other factors in people over 50. And what they found was that there was no correlation between all-cause mortality and protein intake for the entire cohort. That wasn't the headline that you read, though.
Yeah.
What they then did was divide the groups into 50 to 65 and older 65, over 65. And they found that in the 50 to 65 group, eating meat increased the risk, the deaths from cancer and all cause deaths. But in the over 65 group, it decreased it. And those two things balanced each other out so that the overall mortality was unchanged or uncorrelated with protein intake. So right there, that's a little bit of a red flag. You know, when you got to do a subgroup analysis to pull out an effect and, you know, the overall population doesn't have the effect. So why did they break it up at 65? You know, is that because that's what made the data look positive? You know, it's hard to say, you know?
Maybe. 65 is kind of a magic number in aging, right? I mean, it's looked as like a moment of, you know, passage of some sort.
But it's not. It's just, you know, biologically.
It's another number, right?
Now, I will say there is a little bit of plausibility in the protective effect of proteins in older patients because there's actually other studies which demonstrate that eating, you know, having enough protein in your diet when you're older, when you're geriatric population, which is where the 65 comes from, can be protective because people do tend to lose a lot of muscle mass as they get older. Exercise is also really, really important when you're in your middle ages and when you're older to you know, stave off the loss of muscle mass.
That's why I'm planning to start lifting around when I'm 70.
Yeah.
I'm going to start pumping iron. Yep.
You're going to start then?
It's on the schedule.
No, it's all right. Start with 1 pound weights. Go up.
So you're going to be like a 75-year-old beefcake version of Rebecca?
Yeah. I'm going to be ripped, man.
Another thing I found suspicious about the study was that they found that the increased death risk for those 50 to 65 existed even for the medium protein intake group. It wasn't just the high protein intake. So I don't know. That just doesn't comport with data from other studies that I'm familiar with. You know, they also didn't separate out like what kind of meat protein, like whether it's processed or not processed or whatever. They also, it was all protein. So it's just that the animal derived proteins were worse than plant derived proteins, but having just an intermediate or high protein intake, like 10% or over of your caloric intake being from proteins was associated with an increased death rate. Now, some critics have pointed out that the lead author on the study markets an all plant derived protein meal replacement product.
Oh.
And that might be a conflict of interest. The study itself was fine, but it's really just the interpretation that's like, really, it sounds like they're kind of forcing it a little bit. Also, the comparison to smoking, I think, is totally bogus because first of all, they're talking about relative risk, not absolute risk. The relative increase in risk may be similar to smoking, but they didn't give the absolute risk in the study, you know, so in other words, like if the mortality went from 1% to 4%, that would have been a four-fold increase. but it's only a 3% absolute increase. Whereas, you know, smoking, you know, dramatically increases your risk of getting cancer and dying, and not by, but you know, the absolute risk is huge, not just the relative risk. So the comparison is not legitimate, and that's just the shocking headline. Meat is as bad as smoking. It's bullshit. So, I mean, again, there have been previous studies which have showed that, you know, you only in the highest levels of processed meat eating do you start to get some adverse health effects, you know, not in the medium level of eating meat or protein. So this would go against that. All right, Evan, get us up to date quickly on who's that noisy?
Who in the hell are you?
Who in the hell is that noisy? Here we go. Yeah. Uh-huh. Give it to me. Get those coins.
Yay! I know what that is.
Thank you. I completed the whole level in just about 15 seconds there. Well, we obviously know what the song is itself. You know, the Super Mario Brothers theme, but on what instrument was that played?
It sounded like a steel drum.
Yeah, kind of.
It does sound like a steel drum, and that would have been my first guess too. However, it is not. It's an instrument called a sheng, S-H-E-N-G. It's one of the oldest Chinese instruments, with images depicting its kind dating back to 1100 BCE.
Was it percussive?
Yeah, it's a wind instrument.
Oh, weird. Okay.
It's a wind instrument. So it looks like a bunch of, basically, you hold it, right? So it's a instrument, you sit down, you play it in your lap. It has a bunch of pipes, almost like organ pipes,
yeah,
you know, of various sizes and lengths.
Who got it?
Lots of correct answers, but there can be only one. Derek Leskey from Scotland is this week's winner. Well done, Derek. We'll put your name in the drawing at the end of the year, and if you're the grand winner, you will come on the show next year. Join us for Science or Fiction, so congratulations. I wanted to also give a shout-out to listener. Their name is Cola Johnson, for submitting this week's Who's That Noisy to us for use. Thank you very much. And I also wanted to throw out last week, you guys remember the turtle mating
mm-hmm.
one?
Mm-hmm.
The person who sent us the link for that, her name, Sharon Tender. Some very cool names we're throwing around today. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Sharon, and thank you, Cola, also for your contributions.
Cola's an awesome name.
All right, so this week I found myself. So, you know, that's no one gets credit for that one except me. And here we go. See if you guys recognize this voice.
But the attempt at inflation is to explain this by assuming that if there were very small irregularities when the universe was small, that because of this exponential expansion, it would smooth the universe out to the kind of regularity that we see now.
All right, interesting.
Give it a guess. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email, and our forums are sguforums.com. Post your answer there as well. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan. All right, well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Jennifer Ouellette. Jennifer, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You were just pointing out before we started recording that this is our first Skype encounter, although we actually met you in person at a previous TAM.
Yes, that was a lot of fun. Skype is also fun, but it's a little different experience because now you're on little screens.
So we have you on today to talk to you about your latest book. This is your fourth book, I believe. Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. So this is a book about yourself, but also just everyone trying to figure out what makes them unique or different, or are we unique? So tell us about your journey in writing this book.
You know, it's a bit of a departure for me because I normally write about physics and math and things like that. But I got very interested in the idea of how we construct a self when I was doing my book on calculus, because I had this notion of myself as someone who was bad at math for like decades. Probably because I didn't particularly like it that much, and I became one of those people that hates the mere sight of an equation. But when I went back and checked my high school records, I realized that I was actually very good at math. I got A's in it. So where did this sense of my identity come from that I was bad at math? And I'm also adopted, so the whole nature versus nurture thing is something that really has a very immediate relevance to me. In fact, that was one of the first things I did for the book. I went for the very obvious things first. I got my genotype done, I got my brain scan, I took some personality tests, and then from there it became clear that those were only measuring small pieces, and that what we think of as self is actually kind of much broader and a lot more malleable and flexible. I mean, we mean many different things when we talk about the self. So I ended up kind of really expanding the scope of the book even further and kind of looking at social self and personal identity and the online self, the extension of self, which is what we're doing right now with little avatars or photos to represent us in the virtual space. And we, you know, it just becomes this whole very different sphere when you broaden your definition like that. But all of those things are part of the self.
It sounds like it must have been a lot of fun doing all that.
It was. I mean, you know, let's face it, we're all slightly narcissistic at heart, you know. We're born and we see the world through this eye, the eye, and we don't know what a world would be like without that. I was originally going to call the book It's All About Me, but it's not actually all about me. I really do keep the personal stuff to a minimum. I want it to illuminate the actual science rather than actually being all about me, per se.
And yet this is your most personal book, or certainly your most personal set of writings to date.
Yeah, I think so. It definitely is very, very personal, because you've got to go places, right? So I ended up talking about certain formative experience, certain things like losing a very good friend to AIDS that was very, really helped, really shaped me, the adult that I became. Specifically when it comes to thinking about the soul, that's something that he died and I went to retrieve his body at the hospital and it was literally a sack of meat. And I think every person who has seen the dead body of a loved one has the same reaction. Where did they go? Where did this person that we know and love go? Because what's left is clearly not animate. I mean, they are definitely gone. It's why I think we still hang on to this notion of a ghost in a machine, that old Descartes dualism. But, you know, modern neuroscience says that that's not the case, that it's not a ghost, a case of the ghost in the machine. It's a consciousness or the soul is sort of an emergent property instead. So that was a really fun thing for me to explore, because it was something I'd been thinking about a long time. I could definitely see why people thought there must be a soul, because that it seems like something has departed when you see the body of a loved one.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting experience that, and this, you know, I'm a physician, so I know, like, when a patient dies, they instantly become a corpse. And they're treated completely differently. You know, the moment ago, this was a person, a patient, et cetera. And now you declare them dead and now they're a hunk of meat.
Right.
You know,
and it's weird. It's this weird transformation that happens, but it's a very real thing, you know? And so I kind of looked into this notion of emergence, and you know, the self is very much a construct. I always sort of back away from calling it illusion. I know that's kind of a popular thing. But when you understand how emergence works, and this is where my physics comes in, if you think of a chunk of gold, it's made up of billions of gold atoms. And it has properties that are very measurable and very real, like temperature, like hardness, things like that. Those properties are emergent. They're not found in the atoms themselves. They're something that emerges when all the atoms come together and start interacting with each other to form the hunk of gold. And that's what happens with neuron activity in the brain. You reach this threshold where you get enough connections, interconnections between all the brain's neurons and things, and they're all talking to each other, and it's all getting integrated across this vast network of networks. And at some point, you hit a critical threshold where an emergent thing comes out of it, and that is the conscious self.
You know, Jennifer, after you just described the brain that way, you made me think of something pretty cool. Like, what if there were a brain that was 100 times the size of a human brain? Would there be some other type of consciousness or some other type of level? You know what I mean? Like, it could go to infinite depth. That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we don't know, because we haven't experienced a brain like that. But we have studied, or neuroscientists have studied, lesser brains. And I talked to Patricia Churchland, who's a neurophilosopher, because I was kind of floundering on the consciousness chapter at first. And she said, you know, you're asking the wrong question. What you really want to ask is, how rich is your self-representation? And that's really what levels of consciousness are. The more complex your brain gets, the more multi-layered your self-representation comes. So I would say we can extrapolate that to a much bigger brain than ours, and there would just be many, many more layers of this self-representation. You know, we're capable of advanced cognition and thought. You know, we can debate these issues on Skype, and we can write poetry and create art and do all these things. I can only imagine what a higher intelligence with a much bigger brain would be able to do, because they're, I mean, obviously we can't put ourselves in that position, but it would be similar. It would be adding extra layers on top of what we already have.
Did you gain any insight in this process as to why you think we're so fascinated with ourselves? Just part of the human condition?
I think that's just part of the human condition, but also I think it's part, there, we have this need for give and take. You know, we build our sense of self. You know, we have an internal self, but we have to also orient ourselves in space because we have a body as well. So we look to things in our environment. We look for mirrors of some sort so we can get a better clear idea of who we are and how we fit in space. We try and get feedback, whether it's feedback from friends, from a mirror, from physical reality, so that we know that, you know, hey, when I, you know, touch this table, I feel pain. But, you know, so clearly there's a delineation here between me and this other thing. You know, that's where I end and something else begins, is in that collision. So I think it's just a natural feature of the human condition.
Jennifer, I have a profound question. If you, and I'm dead serious about this, but you know the idea that if you're put into a teleporter and you're atomized or turned into energy and then you're reconstructed on the other end like Captain Kirk, is that other person you, or were you killed on this end and were you reconstituted on the other end and you're the same person, a quote unquote person?
You have just brought up the naughtiest problem in philosophy.
I'm just curious about what you think, because I have a very specific opinion on this.
I actually think that it is not the same you, because it's a completely different set of atoms, and mind is matter. And so if you're changing the matter, even, you know, if you're like destroying all the atoms and rebuilding the information, yes, the information is the same, but the atoms are different. So it'll be a lot like you, but I don't see how it could be exactly like you. I mean, there is some aspect where it's not entirely the original you. That's kind of my take.
That's the correct answer, by the way.
Oh, yay!
But we're going to move on because we're not going to get sucked into this conversation again on this show.
So, Jennifer, the conclusion of your book, if you had to summarize the most important point that you discovered while writing this book, what would that be?
You know, it's in the final chapter, I think, because we want to know about, you know, I set out wanting to know how all these different elements come together to form this unique, cogitating, individual whole, like unlike anybody else. And I took a lot of tests, and there's all the different things. There's the genes, there's your synapses in the brain, there's the interactions that you have with the people and your environment, and all these things kind of come together, and it evolves over time as you accumulate life experience. But ultimately, even though you can measure right down to hypothetically, the individual atoms in your body and things like that, all of that information is useless without some sort of unifying interpretive layer. So I think I ended up talking about the autobiographical self and how we build a narrative, that this is how we make sense out of who we are. In that sense, the self really is very much a construct, even more so than in the brain and consciousness sense of the term. But we actually construct a narrative and a story to make sense of all these things. And without that layer to interpret the results, it's meaningless. And I guess the best way I have to think about it is if you look at a digital picture of a cute little puppy. On one level, it's a gorgeous little puppy, but if you broke it down, it's zeros and ones. And those zeros and ones are absolutely crucial, and they very much make up what that picture is, but it's meaningless without that interpretive layer so that we can actually see the image. And so that's kind of how I think about the narrative self or the autobiographical self. It's very, very important to this process of really getting a unification to everything that goes into constructing a self.
So has your outlook on yourself and the way you manage your life changed?
Yeah, I had not realized to what extent the self is very much constructed, I think. I mean, one of the chapters is I dropped acid for like the first time in my life because a friend of mine, it's a funny story, he basically said, look, if you're really interested in the self and how we construct identity, you have to try acid. And my initial reaction was, oh, you're just a hippie. You know, he's from the Woodstock generation. Of course you'd say that. But he said, no. He says, because if you really want to experience what it's like not to have that ego, that's what you need to do. He goes, but I have to warn you that when you come down, the self is going to come roaring back, and believe me, you'd better like what you see. So, of course, now I had to do it. And so my husband, Sean, and I actually performed an experiment, a very controlled experiment. We controlled the environment. We had someone on call in case there was a medical emergency, none of which we actually needed. And one of the things I learned was that I become that person at the party on acid. I'm the person going around touching everything, going, whoa, this is amazing. And it's like an oriental rug.
Oh, my God, this is awesome. So were you scared going into it? Were you nervous about trying something so profound?
You know, so many people have dropped acid so many times over the years. I was not scared. I figured, you know, we're controlling the environment. I'd interviewed a lot of neuroscientists and people who worked in this area beforehand and gotten a lot of good advice. A lot of it depends on how you set the stage. I think I would not have wanted to take it at a loud party. I think that would have been very upsetting. But because it was in this nice, calm beach house nature environment and it was just the two of us and, you know, there's a safeness there. It was a very good way. When they did these experiments with LSD, they used them in psychotherapy in the 1950s. Cary Grant, for instance, dropped acid as part of his psychotherapy. They would always isolate them and cover their eyes with blindfolds and pipe in classical music to control the experience to a certain extent. So it's really specific to the individual, and I guess I'm just kind of a happy person in general. So I had a really good experience. But you really do, it's not so much that the ego goes away. I think that it's more, it messes with your sense of self and other, you know, that those boundaries. I couldn't take notes because my hand kept melting into the paper. And I loved the granite countertop in the kitchen because I'd put my hand on it and the pattern would swirl up my skin and I would be like getting this like tattoo, you know, and boulders will pulse as if they're breathing. And I spent a lot of time, Sean has the most boring video footage of me staring at a plank in the deck chair because the wood just kind of opened up and I could see the molecules. And it's a really good experience in that respect because it does make you realize that yes, there's an I there, and that I is that conscious self. But the rest of your brain constructs your physical self, your sense of self in space and time. All of that is very much a construct. So I've never really kind of looked at reality the same way since.
Yeah, even the most basic things that we take for granted, like you are separate from the universe, is actually a construct of your brain. There's a circuit in your brain that makes you feel that way. And if you disrupt that, then you meld with the universe. You know, that your construction of yourself and reality is malleable infinitely if you can disrupt the right circuit in the brain.
Right. And that was really illuminating for me because you really do feel disembodied, like you're floating, which I thought was great. I mean, but I can imagine that some people would find that extremely upsetting.
Well, Jennifer, it was certainly fascinating and enjoyable to have you back on the show.
That was my pleasure. Always a pleasure to chat with you guys.
Are we going to see you at any of the future conferences?
I hope so. I haven't decided which or where I'm going this summer, but generally I go to one or two a year. So at some point you'll see me.
All right. Thanks again. Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have another theme this week. Don't panic. It's a mild theme. The theme is percent. Each of the items will contain some percentage in there somewhere.
Pepper tree.
A loose theme. There are pepper trees, by the way.
Yeah. It's not really a tree, Steve. It's more of a bush.
No. There's an actual pepper tree. It's the pink version.
The pink
of
one.
Yeah.
But it's not the peppercorn.
It's not related. It's a different species, obviously. Trees and a vine can only be so closely related. Yeah. It's a different species entirely. All right. Well, let's move on. Ready?
Guess who's going first?
Item number one. A new study finds that 25% of clinical trials are discontinued prior to their completion. Item number two, researchers find that subjects fail to identify fake photo IDs where the picture does not match the person 45% of the time. And item number three, researchers studying concession stand sales at sporting events find that the inclusion of healthy options, such as fruit and cheese, caused sales to drop by 30%. For no particular reason at all, Jay, go first.
All right, this first one about the new study that finds 25% of the clinical trials are discontinued prior to their completion. Sure. I think that is a legitimate number, and there could be a ton of reasons why a trial is discontinued. There could have been errors in their methodology. They could have run out of money. Lots of different things. So I think that one is science. Yeah, this one about the fake IDs and they only find the fake photo 45% of the time. That's very subjective. And I could see the number being that poorly. And there's probably a lot of different things here. So, you know, first you're saying that the research, we're saying find that subjects fail to identify. So who are the subjects? Are we talking about in a dark bar? Are we talking about a police officer? You know, who are the people that are being tested about the fake pictures? And I think that this one is so subjective, it's really hard to nail it down either way, even with a rigorous study. Interesting. But 45%, sure. I mean, but I could even argue that it would be worse than that. So that one is a maybe. Okay, then the one about the inclusion of fruit and cheese or a healthy option at a concession stand caused the sales to drop by 30%. Ah, that is awesome. See, it would work with me. If there were healthy options, I would tend to probably buy a lot more because I'm usually always trying to eat healthy. But I could see this happening, but I also could see that this is 100% wrong, like meaning that, it increases the sales by 30%. So between, the one about the photo ID and this one saying that it decreases the sale, I think the photo ID one, there's something weird about this last one here, though, about the freaking fruit. Caused sales to drop by 30%. All right. You know, I think I'm going to go with that one as the fake, the fruit one.
Okay, Rebecca.
The 25% of clinical trials being discontinued before the completion is, like, if anything, that number is low. I mean, we talk about this sort of thing all the time. So that makes sense to me. I agree with Jay. I would really like to know who the subjects are in this fake ID study. But in order for it to be, like, assuming that it's double blinded, then no matter what, the subjects maybe didn't know that they were looking for fake IDs. Maybe they were distracted by something else. And if that was the case, then I can absolutely see this happening. Like, you know, if you look up videos that Darren Brown or Richard Wiseman have done on change blindness, people rarely pay attention to this sort of stuff. If they don't know what to look for exactly, then I can see people completely failing to realize. And also, if you've ever played Papers, Please, if you have like a multitude of things to look for on a potentially fake ID, like, there have been times when I haven't noticed that the picture just completely does not even match the person in front of me. So, yeah, that one.
You have that face thing, paraphernalia.
Well, I do have prosopagnosia, but in Papers, right. Please, you know, two dimensions are usually a lot easier. So if I pay attention to it, then yeah, I can usually tell in Papers, Please, if the person doesn't match their ID. Although there is a handy button. You can just push the button and it'll tell you if there's a discrepancy or not. But there have been many times I haven't even pushed the button. So healthy options reducing sales at a concession stand, that stands out to me because I'm trying to remember. I feel like we've talked in the past about studies that looked at McDonald's, or maybe we haven't talked about it on here, but I've seen studies on fast food places like McDonald's that offer quote unquote healthy options like salads and stuff like that. And while the healthy options might not sell well, they actually seem to increase people buying the unhealthy options. Similar, like, weird stuff happens when you put calorie information on menus and stuff like that. So I can't see how providing healthy options would cause sales to drop by 30%, because it's not like those options would be less money, and I don't think that those options are necessarily guilting people into buying less crap, because that doesn't seem to be borne out by previous research. So I'm going to GWJ on this one and say that that's the fiction.
Alrighty, Bob. Yeah, the 25% clinical trials. Yeah, that does make sense. And I think that's might be a little bit low as well. So I'm fine with that one. The fake photo ID. Yeah, this is so ambiguous. I think we're meant to assume that, it's like a bouncer at a bar checking IDs. And often, you know, it is dark and you're really just looking at the age, you know, making sure the age of the person's right. And I could see them totally missing the fact that the picture doesn't match, but it depends, you know, how much doesn't it match? Is it there a gender difference? I mean, if it's blatant, I think it would stand out, but so there's so many unknowns with that. But the concession one, yeah, that one stands out for me as well. I mean, if you're at a sporting event, I don't think anything is going to stop people from, like, buying beer. even if they were selling like pig testicles, they won't know. I don't think they would care what the hell else they sell. They're gonna get their beer. And I agree with Jay. I could see this being the opposite, actually increasing, because I mean, if I went to a sporting event, I don't know if there'd be much I would buy at the concession stands. But if they had something helpful like that, it could cause an increase from the people that just don't buy the usual junk that they sell. So, this one, kind of rubs me the wrong way compared to the other one. So I'll say that one is fiction, concession stands.
All right. And Evan.
This is the hard part about going last because, you know, especially if the other three have gone a certain direction and you want to latch onto it, it seems weak. But in any case, yeah. So I've been to a lot of sporting events in my time. I can't recall there being many healthy options on display. But that aside, again, this is a research and causing sales to drop by 30%, way, way too much. No way. They'll just choose the other option and probably largely ignore it. I don't think sales will drop at all. Fiction.
Okay. So you guys all agree on number three. So let's take these in order. Number one, a new study finds that 25% of clinical trials are discontinued prior to their completion. You all think this one is science, and this one is...
Might be the fiction.
What if I told you the actual percentage was 24.9%?
Oh, you got us. You got us.
Never.
No.
I thought you were going to come and say
50%. This one is science. Yeah, it was 24.9%. I rounded it off to 25%. So,
would wake up with the head of a bird in your bed.
With a banana plant in my bed. Only 38% of which reported the fact that they stopped the trial to their ethics committees, which they're supposed to do. That was more disturbing. What do you think was the most common reason for stopping the trial prematurely? And most of those, not all, but most went unpublished.
The participants. Yeah.
Breaking the protocol.
Failed.
Money.
Just failure to recruit.
Failure to recruit. Oh.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
You don't think about that, but that's actually one of the most challenging parts of clinical trials. I was in a trial once where the inclusion criteria, in retrospect, made it almost impossible to recruit people. You know?
Left-handed
jugglers. Without going to all the details. No, I mean, they're all reasonable on paper. You know, you have to be off drugs for so many months and have this and that. You know, it's all things
what?
That were...
That's impossible.
You know, but... finding somebody that fit those criteria, God, were hard.
On the other hand, can I just briefly say a friend of mine was running a trial once and had a person who kept falling asleep in the middle of what they were supposed to be doing. And when they woke up, they wouldn't admit that they had fallen asleep. And so by the rules that the researchers were abiding by, they weren't allowed to kick this person out of the study. So they had to like take their results as part of their full results, and it like skewed everything.
It's hard to foresee all ends. Even Frodo can't do it. Okay, let's go on to number two. Researchers find that subjects fail to identify fake photo IDs where the picture does not match the person 45% of the time. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is remarkably relevant to our earlier news item about the plane going
passports.
Down. The two fake passports. I had to keep reminding myself not to bring this up when we were talking about that news item. It's like, oh, I just read a study that showed that this one is science. This one is science.
Yay!
Right.
Kicked your butt.
Yeah, this was under like pretty ideal viewing conditions. These were volunteers, not people who do this for a living. They showed them like a big glossy picture of a volunteer, a subject. And then they had a student ID photo of the same person from 7 years earlier. And it either matched them or it didn't match them. What they found was that when they would do like 200 pairs and they would just try to say, is it a match or is it not a match? When 10% of the match of the pairs did not match, that was their reflection of an infrequent mismatch. The subjects missed the mismatch 45% of the time. When the mismatch was present 50% of the time, then the observers missed it only 20% of the time. So, if anything, though, in a real life situation, I mean, the mismatches are probably more infrequent than 10%. So that it would suggest that it would probably be even worse. You know, the less frequent it is, the higher the rate of missing the mismatch. Does that make sense? It raises a lot of concerns. You know, we tend to take for granted that the guy there looking at your passport, you know, is looking you up and down, that they're going to recognize that that's you. But probably a lot of us think that, you know, they don't, you don't really look like your picture anymore, but you don't realize that that's probably very frequent. So people might have changed their haircut, their facial hair. They may have gained or lost weight. They may be several years older than their picture. So it could be hard, you know, to recognize people that you don't know in unfamiliar, with unfamiliar details. You know, it's like I would recognize Jay anywhere, you know, in any context or whatever, because I'm intimately familiar with him because he's my brother. But would you recognize somebody you've never seen before, you know, in two different states, one in their picture and one in whatever they are right now?
Connecticut, so, New York.
It's, yeah. So that the primary system that we use to sort of screen people getting onto planes, just looking at their ID, whether it's a passport or a driver's license or whatever, it's not that accurate. We're relying on people to do something that they're just not that good at. So I do wonder if training can improve the quality there, you know, the hit rate. Because these were untrained volunteers. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's why I asked, like, who is it?
Yeah, just volunteers, yeah. All this means that researchers studying concession stand sales at sporting events find that the inclusion of healthy options such as fruit and cheese caused sales to drop by 30% is fiction, as you guys all figured out. In fact, the results of the study showed that there was absolutely no change in sales or profit. All right, so good job again this week, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clearly, I have to make these more challenging.
Yeah,
I'll rectify that.
Oh, God. Don't. Come on, Steve. We're just, you know, everything's cool. Like, yeah. No reason.
All right, be cool, man. Be cool.
Yeah, be cool, brother. Okay, so I have a quote from a listener named Elizabeth Mezjek. And Elizabeth is in Illinois. And she sent in an awesome quote that was, of course, said by Neil deGrasse Tyson on the Colbert Report on 3/10/2014. The quote is, "Once a scientific truth emerges from consensus of experiments and observations, it is the way of the world. So say science. When different experiments give you the same result, it is no longer subject to your opinion. That's the good thing about science. It is true whether or not you believe in it. That's why it works." Neil deGrasse Tyson!
Good job, Jay. Good choice for a quote this week.
Thank you.
So, guys, we got Nexus, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, coming up in New York City, April 11th to 13th.
Yeah, so Friday, we have our Friday workshops, which are lots of different things, you know, music and skepticism, do-it-yourself biology, the edge of skepticism, science using the handheld microscope. God, I would love to go to that. The art of skepticism, critical thinking, science and skepticism. That's the one you're doing, Steve, right?
Yeah.
And then from 5 to 7, we're going to have the speaker reception. So if you can't make it to the whole conference and you want to come show your support or just meet some of the speakers, you can purchase that ticket separately. You can also purchase the workshop separately if you want to. 7:30 to 9:30, we have stimulus response. And as I've said before, this is something you really got to see because we're going to have live music that's going to have science and pseudoscientific prose read over, kind of like a beatnik type of jazzy type of live music jivey thing going on. It's going to be fun. But the best part, in my opinion, is going to be the Making Fun of Steve Novella Hour, which is going to be all about an interview with Steve. And then stand-up comedians are going to improv mocking and making fun of Steve and his entire life, which I'm going to absolutely freaking love and laugh my ass off.
Yeah, so that stimulus response is a standalone entertainment event. You don't have to come to the whole conference. You can get tickets for that separately. So if you're just looking for something to do Friday night and you can't make the whole conference, you can still come and meet us at Stimulus Response. The conference itself, of course, is going to be, you know, chock full of science and skeptical speakers. We have Lawrence Krauss as the keynote. I'm moderating a debate panel on GMO. I'm really looking forward to that. We have Paul Offit, Elise Andrew from I F and Love Science, and lots of other speakers. Just check out nexus.org. And you can look at the full speaker lineup that we have. It's going to be awesome.
So March 20th, that's this Thursday. You could still get the early bird pricing, and then after that, prices go up. So if you're interested, you should buy now.
Yeah, but at any time, remember, if you're an SGU member, you get the 10% discount. And if you haven't gotten the code from us, just email us, and we'll give it to you. Well, guys, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome,
thank
Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.